Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, January 11th, 2026. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes the following names: Jacqueline Carol Accomazzo, Mary Maxine Allen, Terrence P. Black, known as Terry, Kevin Michael Callaghan, Nancy A. Campbell, Margie Peterson Cottier, Patricia A. Dreiling, Sherry Lynn Larson Huff, Teresa Ann Inalbon, Naomi Melanie Jackson, Gina Johnson, Pauline Morney, Richard Carl Nickel, Linda Ann Rondeau, Joseph Patrick Skelly, Dorothy May Sidenor, Charles Philip Thompson, and Carol Ann Wagner. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends his condolences to the families and friends of today's individuals listed in the obituaries. And now we'll turn to the economy section of the paper. Well, it looks like there's two articles today on the economy page. The first one was written by Karina Vanek for the Arizona Republic. It is entitled, Arizona's Unemployment Rate Rises. Arizona's unemployment rate ticked up slightly from September to November, reaching 4.3%. That's up 0.1% over that two-month period, according to research that was just released by the Arizona Office of Economic Opportunity. Despite the increase, the state still posted lower unemployment than the national rate of 4.6%, and it was below Arizona's pre-pandemic average, which was about 4.9%. The data covers 2 months of job numbers after the federal government shut down, altered the release schedule of federal jobs data. Over the two-month span, the state's labor force increased by about 27,000 individuals. From October to November, the sectors that recorded the most job growth were trade, transportation, utilities, and government. Walls said the state also looks at unemployment insurance claims to help forecast unemployment data, and said that from December 2024 to December 2025, both the initial claims, meaning people who were applying for the first time, and the regular claims were down 15% and 16% respectively. Economic conditions, including many outside of Arizona's influence, could dictate the state of the market going into 2026. Doug Walls is the Labor Market Information Director for the Arizona Office of Economic Opportunity. He said he will continue to watch the Consumer Price Index and the federal interest rates. Now, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics data, housing prices nationally rose 4% over the 12-month period that ended in August 2025, and during that same period, food prices rose 3.2%. The Phoenix metro area had more stable prices during that time. Housing prices fell 0.1% during that time, and food prices increased only 1% during that time. The number of both multifamily and single-family home building permits were issued also decreased during that period of time, with multifamily permits down about 30% and single-family permits down 12%. Only two Arizona employers announced major layoffs in December, though some other large employers could also cut jobs in the state. Amazon is expected to announce additional corporate layoffs following a large layoff announcement last October. The DoubleTree by Hilton Phoenix in Tempe announced that it would close in early January, laying off 114 people. Franklin Foods, which is a cream cheese manufacturer, announced that it would close its Casa Grande plant, laying off 83 people. And that was Karina Vanek's article, Arizona's Unemployment Rate Rises. The other article from the economy section of the paper is entitled Spotify Expanding Monetization Program. This was written by Jaspreet Singh for the Reuters News Group. Spotify is expanding its monetization program for creators and introducing new tools for video podcasters as it aims to better compete with YouTube and Netflix in the booming market. Spotify is a Swedish company, a Swedish streaming company, and on January 7th, they said it has invested more than $10 billion in the podcast industry over the past 5 years to drive creator earnings and scale engagement and build infrastructure. It is now lowering the thresholds to join its monetization program, which occurred a year after the initiative was launched. Roman Wassenmuller, in a media briefing, said, quote, "Since launching the program, monthly video podcast consumption on Spotify has nearly doubled," unquote. And then he went on and said, quote, "The average Spotify podcast user streams twice as many video shows per month as they did before the launch," unquote. Well, the move comes at a time when platforms are jostling for video podcast creators in a bid to tap the rising demand for such content, as well as the higher engagement that it offers. Spotify creators can now qualify for the program with 1,000 engaged audience members, or 2,000 hours consumed over the past 30 days, and 3 published episodes. Now, that was in the last part prior to that requirement. It was 2,000 listeners, 10,000 hours consumed, and 12 published episodes. So they have made it easier to qualify for the program. The company said creators in the program can earn from ads on free tiers and other platforms, but video creators get an additional revenue stream as they are paid directly by Spotify when premium subscribers watch their videos ad-free. Spotify will also roll out new sponsorship management tools in April and let creators easily publish and monetize video podcasts directly from third-party hosting platforms like Acast and Audioboom and Libsyn. It also unveiled that Spotify Sycamore Studios, which will be the new home for the Ringer podcast, and it will be available to select creators. So alongside its facilities in London and New York, the move will help creators avoid the cost of renting facilities, according to Spotify's head of content partnerships, Jordan Newman. And that was the article from Reuters, Spotify Expanding Monetization Program. We're coming up on 9 minutes past the hour. Time for us to move on over to the sports page. The cover story is all about the women's Final Four in the WNBA. Teams we might see at the 2026 Women's Final Four in Phoenix. Written by Jenna Ortiz for the Arizona Republic. NCAA Women's Final Four contender, the UConn Huskies. The number one ranked Huskies are a heavy favorite to go undefeated in the regular season, which also makes them a heavy favorite for the Final Four. The program's 15 wins and 0 losses start marks its best opening since the 2017 season, when it won its first 36 contest before falling in overtime 91-89 to Notre Dame in the national championship game. Sophomore forward Sarah Strong, at the forefront of UConn's success, has made a compelling case for National Player of the Year. Guard Azee Fudd has also been playing a big role, furthering the Huskies' bid for a repeat as champions. Then we have another NCAA Women's Final Four contender, the Texas Longhorns. It's been another big season for the number 2 ranked Texans as the Longhorns basically drifted through non-conference play. Their record is 17-0. They didn't have an easy schedule, but they made quick work of several top 25 teams, including a 76-65 win over then-ranked number 3 UCLA. Only South Carolina and Ole Miss have challenged the Longhorns so far, with Texas winning by one possession in both games. Fifth-year point guard Rory Harmon is one of the best in the country and has been the engine for the team. Leading scorer Madison Booker has been having another productive season with at least 20 points in 5 of her past 7 games through January 6th. The Longhorns have a great shot of getting back to the Final Four for the second consecutive year. Then we have the South Carolina Gamecocks. Under coach Don Staley, the Gamecocks are always in consideration for the Final Four. Since losing in last season's national title game against UConn, South Carolina has dealt with a great deal of adversity in a short span. The Gamecocks received unfortunate news when their forward, Chloe Kitts, tore her ACL in September, sidelining her for the season. More recently, the key transfer, Tania Latson, injured her ankle in late December and has been seen as day-to-day. That starting guard has averaged 16.9 points this season and was the scoring leader last season at North Carolina State with 25.2 points per game. However, the Gamecocks have found ways to continue their high-level play. Sophomore forward Joyce Edwards leads the team with 21 points. Center Medina Okot has been stellar with 11.5 rebounds per game. South Carolina will soon receive more help in the post with Alicia Turnabies, who is a 6'7" player from France, joining the team mid-season and gearing up to play. And then we have the UCLA Bruins, one of the more experienced teams in the NCAA. The Bruins have a great shot of making their second straight Final Four appearance, especially with its potentially being center Lauren Betts' final season. Betts is expected to go in the top 5 of the 2026 WNBA draft. She has surpassed 1,500 career points and has made the important defensive plays in the biggest moments for the Bruins. While Betts has been key to UCLA's success, she has also been surrounded by depth in the senior starters Kiki Rice, Gianna Nepens, Charlize Ledger-Walker, and Gabriela Jaquez. UCLA's starting lineup has combined to play 581 collegiate games. That can play a big factor in winning the Big Ten championship and eventually reaching the Final Four. Then we have the Oklahoma Sooners. There are a lot of SEC teams that have impressed this season, and the Sooners have shown that they deserve to be considered with the likes of Texas and South Carolina. The program has steadily improved under fourth-year head coach Jenny Baranczyk, who took Oklahoma to its first Sweet 16 since 2013. She did it last season. Baranczyk has taken the Sooners to at least the second round of the NCAA tournament in all 4 seasons. Oklahoma, with a record of 14-1, has only gotten better, adding the highly touted recruit Alaya Chavez to its roster. That guard leads the Sooners and is fourth among freshmen nationally with 18.9 points per game. The Sooners rank second in scoring offense at 94.5 points per game, while leading the country in field goal percentage defense, 29.8%. as well as leading the country in rebounds per game, 53.1. Senior center Reagan Beers has continued to be a force on the boards, ranking 10th nationally with 10.8 rebounds per game, and she's also second on the team with 17.4 points. only problem is that Oklahoma will have to play Texas and South Carolina in the regular season and potentially in the SEC tournament. One of those teams could hurt the other's chances of gaining a higher seed in the NCAA tournament. Speaking of the tournament, it's going to be in Phoenix, the Mortgage Matchup Center. April 3rd, 4th, and 5th will be the final four games. April 3rd and 5th will be the final four games. And that's the article, Teams We Might See at the 2026 Women's Final Four in Phoenix. Our next article from inside of the sports pages, Kelce gives his Peyton money directly to Efficient Nonprofit, written by Jason Wolf for the Arizona Republic. Kansas City Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce won the Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year Charity Challenge presented by Nationwide. It's a popularity contest on social media. He won it for the third time on Wednesday, January 7th, earning $35,000 for his charity of choice. That donation will go directly to Operation Breakthrough. That's a partner nonprofit in Kansas City. It will go there rather than to Kelce's 87 and Running Foundation, which received the money the previous two times that he won the contest in 2020 and 2024. Kelce's fiancée, the pop star Taylor Swift, also recently donated $250,000 to Operation Breakthrough, which aims to, quote, provide a safe, loving, and educational environment for children in poverty and to empower their families through advocacy, emergency aid, and education, unquote. Lori Styron, who is the CEO and executive director of Charity Watch, that's an independent charity watchdog group, Lori said, quote, as for Kelce's decision to donate his contest winnings to an established charity, in the short term, this was the right call. The people operating the foundation need time to get their accounting, governance, and legal house in order. It was the responsible move under the circumstances, unquote. Operation Breakthrough's Ignition Lab, which is a workforce development program for teens, has received funding from 87 and Running for years. But Kelce's nonprofit, which was founded back in 2015, has recently received scrutiny for its governance and charitable spending, following a review by the Arizona Republic of federal tax records filed by nonprofits that were created by Walter Payton Award nominees. The 87 and Running Foundation told the IRS that it spent 41 cents of every dollar on charitable activities over the last 3 years for which federal tax records are available. And they paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to A&A Management Group, which was co-founded by Kelce's longtime business managers, the brothers Aaron and Andre Eanes. Aaron Eanes told the Republic the nonprofit mistakenly submitted incorrect breakdowns of its expenses to the IRS for nearly a decade, and they committed to correcting the issues moving forward. Aaron is the executive director of the nonprofit, which has no official president, secretary, or treasurer, and just two board members, which is below the minimum of three required to ensure good governance. Lori Styron told the Republic after she reviewed the nonprofit's tax filings, quote, it appears to function more as an extension of the management company versus as an independent public charity. That's not how charities work. It's wrong, unquote. The Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year Award winner and nominees, one from each team, collectively, they receive more than $1.5 million in annual donations from the NFL Foundation and Nationwide Insurance to give to the charities of their choice, often ones the players founded. The winner is announced at NFL Honors the week of the Super Bowl and receives $250,000, while the other 31 nominees each receive $40,000. Now, the Arizona Republic has repeatedly exposed widespread waste and mismanagement among these nonprofits, some of which spend less than 50 cents of every dollar on actual charity. And it's often because the players and their families lack sufficient nonprofit guidance and education. Many of these nonprofits are directed by agents and marketing professionals that work with sports charity management companies geared toward profit and optics over impact. The NFL changed its rules for the Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year Award in 2025, based on the Republic's reporting, to require that players-designated nonprofits adhere to state and federal nonprofit laws. Deion Dawkins of the Buffalo Bills and Jordan Mailata of the Philadelphia Eagles finished second and third in voting for the 2025 Charity Challenge, respectively. They will receive $10,000 and $5,000 donations for the charities of their choice. Dawkins' nonprofit is called Deion's Dreamers. It is not an independent entity, but a fiscally sponsored project of the Edward Charles Foundation. That's a collective that spends 94 cents of every dollar on charitable activities, according to their tax records. Mailata partners directly with established nonprofits like the Philadelphia Children's Alliance or the American Association for Cancer Research and the Eagles Autism Foundation. Kelsey's 87 and Running Foundation reported that it raised $1.5 million and spent $1.1 million between 2024, with $469,000 going to management, $446,000 going to charity, and $182,000 going to fundraising. But Aaron Eanes said the nonprofit's tax filings were filled out incorrectly for nearly a decade. In a written statement, he told the Republic, quote, "Our previous approach to categorizing expenses on our 990 filings did not accurately reflect actual fund usage," unquote. Operational costs for charitable efforts since 2015, quote, "were mistakenly reported under management rather than allocated adequately to program services," unquote, he told the Republic. "So public records do not provide an, quote, indication of where the resources were truly directed," unquote. And then he went on and said, "We have since corrected this. Management fees have decreased significantly in 2024, and they dropped to zero in 2025. Looking ahead, we are expanding our board of directors, bringing on advisors with nonprofit expertise, and restructuring our reporting processes to better reflect our actual program work. We are dedicated to ensuring that this foundation operates at the highest standards." Charity Navigator, a nonprofit watchdog group, expects efficient nonprofits to spend at least 70 cents of every dollar on charity. Charity Watch considers a nonprofit highly efficient when it spends at least 75 cents of every dollar on charity. Its rating system gives nonprofits that spent fewer than 50 cents per dollar on charity a grade of D or F. The amount of each dollar spent on charity is determined by dividing a nonprofit's annual expenses for program services by its total expenses, which are reported on federal tax forms. Now, zooming out over the past decade, since Kelsey's nonprofit was created in 2015, it has reported $3.4 million in revenue and $2.7 million in expenses, with nearly $900,000 going to management and $1.5 million going to charity. That computes to about 56 cents for every dollar spent. Aaron Eanes said, quote, "The management cost covered the necessary operational infrastructure for the foundation to operate effectively, including coordinating fundraising events like the Kelsey Car Jam, maintaining ongoing relationships with partner organizations such as Operation Breakthrough and the University of Cincinnati, overseeing donor communications and the foundation's website, and ensuring the capacity to quickly mobilize resources when community needs arise. Operation Breakthrough is highly efficient according to its most recent tax records. The nonprofit, which was founded in 1971, reported that it received $54.2 million in total revenue over the last 3 years, for which public records are available, and had $51.3 million in total expenses. About $42.8 million was spent on charitable activities. That's about 83 cents of every dollar. Now, that nonprofit reports that it has 19 voting members in its governing body. All of them are independent. Operation Breakthrough congratulated Kelsey for winning the 2025 Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year Charity Challenge on social media. It said, quote, "We're so proud and grateful for his decade-long support and lasting impact on our KC families," unquote. Kelsey has worked with Operation Breakthrough since 2015. That was his rookie year with the Kansas City Chiefs. He said, quote, "To be chosen as the team's Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year is such a great honor. I have so much love for Kansas City and the Chiefs organization, and to be selected once again means everything to me. The opportunity to be involved and help kids through 87 and running and working with Operation Breakthrough, as well as Ignition Lab, has been such a tremendous experience. Coming from Cleveland Heights and having a strong support system has taught me the importance of having the right people around that show up for you and want to see you succeed. Being able to give back to Kansas City and to my hometown, places that have done so much for me, has been a dream come true, and I will never take that for granted. Representing the team, the Hunt family, our fans, and my foundation is incredibly special, and I'm very grateful." That was the article, "Kelsey Gives His Payton Money Directly to Efficient Nonprofit." Our next article in the sports section is written by Dwayne Rankin for the Arizona Republic. "The Suns Set to Begin Marathon Road Trip Versus the Heat." Dwayne Rankin wrote this. "The Phoenix Suns complete a two-game homestand on January 11th against the Washington Wizards before starting a six-game road marathon. January 13th, the Miami Heat. This will be the Phoenix's first game against the Heat this season. The Suns will face them later this month on January 25th at home in the first game for Phoenix after this six-game road trip. Then on January 15th, it's the Detroit Pistons. Like Phoenix, Detroit has been one of the NBA's surprise teams this season, and the Suns and the Pistons will meet again in Phoenix on January 29th. That's the 13th in Miami, the 15th in Detroit, and the 17th of January, they're with the New York Knicks. Sun star guard Devin Booker has always loved playing in Madison Square Garden. That's when he likes to hit that game-winning three to stun the Knicks 116-113 back on November 26th of 2023. After playing on the 17th, on the 19th, they're playing the Brooklyn Nets. The Suns and the Nets will forever be linked with the Kevin Durant trade before the 2023 trade deadline. Phoenix will battle Brooklyn again at home on January 27th. So, to recap, they're going to be playing in Miami on the 13th, Detroit on the 15th, New York on the 17th, the Brooklyn Nets on the 19th, and on January 20th, they're playing the Philadelphia 76ers. This is the first and only back-to-back for Phoenix during this six-game road trip. The Suns will play the Sixers again on February 7th in Phoenix, heading into the NBA All-Star break. And then on January 23rd, they'll play the Atlanta Hawks. Phoenix will close the road trip against the Hawks, who rallied from a 22-point fourth-quarter deficit without the then-injured Trae Young to stun the Suns 124-122 back on November 16th in Phoenix. The Suns' first-year head coach, Jordan Ott, said after the loss as Atlanta outscored Phoenix 47-27 in the fourth quarter, quote, "Overall in the fourth quarter, we lost our way," unquote. Now, the Hawks are reportedly looking to trade Young, who is a four-time All-Star guard who has played all eight of his NBA seasons in Atlanta. And that was Dwayne Rankin's article, Suns Set to Begin Marathon Road Trip versus Heat. We are at 30 minutes past the hour. Time to leave the sports section, move on over to Viewpoints, and read some opinions. On the front page of the Viewpoints section at the top, the opinion was written by Stephen Richer, who is a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he is the former Maricopa County Recorder. His opinion piece is entitled, History Will Frown on Arizonans Who Aided in January 6th. 5 years ago, this week, on January 6th, 2021, President Donald Trump told thousands of his supporters in Washington, D.C., to fight like hell and to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue to protest the allegedly stolen 2020 election. The result of that? More than 140 Capitol police officers assaulted, approximately $3 million in property damage, feces and urine smeared throughout the hallways of Congress, a noose at the Capitol, and cries of "Hang Mike Pence, execute the traitors," zip ties and Molotov cocktails, Secret Service agents who called their families to say goodbye, thinking they would die that day. The first ever violent attempt to stop the transfer of presidential power in American history. At the time, nearly everyone was horrified and outraged. Donald Trump Jr. frantically texted then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to get Trump to call off the protesters. He texted, quote, "He's got to condemn this shit ASAP. The Capitol Police tweet is not enough." Marco Rubio, who is now Secretary of State, wrote this, quote, "There is nothing patriotic about what is occurring on Capitol Hill. This is third world style anti-American anarchy." Former TV personality Tucker Carlson texted his colleagues frequently in the days leading up to January 6th that Trump had no evidence for his stolen election theory. Following January 6th, Carlson texted that Trump, quote, "is a demonic force, a destroyer. They take the president literally. He is to blame for everything that happened today," unquote. Representative Elise Stefanik, considered one of Trump's closest allies, wrote this, quote, "This has been a truly tragic day for America. We all joined together in fully condemning the dangerous violence and destruction that occurred today in our nation's capital. It is anti-America and must be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law," unquote. Greg Gutfeld of Fox News, he promised that, quote, "you will not see Republicans bailing out those who were arrested," unquote. And Senator Lindsey Graham from the Senate floor said this, quote, "all I can say is count me out. Enough is enough," unquote. It was a day that will forever stain American history. Unfortunately, Arizona had its hand in the day's events. Federal prosecutors charged 15 Arizonans in connection with the day's events. Perhaps most famous among them was Jake Angeli, the mascot of the day, the shirtless man with tattoos, a painted face, a fur coat, and a helmet with horns. The QAnon Shaman, as he became known, he later ran for Congress, unsuccessfully, and he sold merchandise with his image. Nathan Wayne Etrican, an Arizona resident, also forcibly entered the Capitol in costume, dressed as Angel Moroni from the Book of Mormon. He received a sentence of 45 days in prison and subsequent probation. Tim Gionet, known as Baked Alaska Online, he live-streamed 27 minutes of his time inside the Capitol, where he screamed threats at Capitol Police and damaged a menorah inside the building, That's behavior consistent with his anti-Semitic history and past arrest. He received a sentence of 60 days in prison. Phoenix and Wilcox resident Edward Vallejo took his case to trial by jury. He received a 3-year sentence for seditious conspiracy. He had stockpiled weapons at a nearby hotel, ready to be delivered to the Oathkeeper gang at the Capitol. Other Arizonans appeared outside the Capitol, including 2-time candidate for Congress Jeff Zink, former state legislator Anthony Kern. Neither seemingly criminally entered the Capitol, but Kern would later be criminally indicted for his role in the false electors scheme. Arizonans also contributed significantly in the lead-up to January 6th. Former Arizona Republican Party chairwoman Kelly Ward pressured county officials to stop the counting on election night. She also repeatedly accused Dominion voting systems of flipping votes from Trump to Joe Biden. False allegations that would ultimately net Dominion hundreds of millions of dollars in defamation damages from Fox News, Newsmax, and others. And Kelly Ward led the scheme to replace the Biden electors with Trump electors, a key ingredient in the events of January 6th, and an action that led to her criminal indictment. I still have text messages from state legislator Mark Fincham asking me to help prevent the certification of Arizona's 2020 votes. He sent those texts at the time he was organizing a conference in downtown Phoenix that featured Rudy Giuliani and plenty of theories, but no facts as to how the election was stolen and how Trump could remain president. Fincham was also at the Capitol on January 6th. Turning Point USA, that youth group headquartered in Arizona, they helped finance January 6 events. They bussed hundreds into Washington, D.C. for the rally that later turned into a riot. Charlie Kirk, the former CEO of Turning Point, tweeted and then deleted a celebratory post about Turning Point's 80-plus buses full of patriots. Another Arizonan and Turning Point leader, Tyler Boyer, pushed the legal theory that Vice President Mike Pence could ignore the results of the election. Quote, "It's pretty simple. VP has the awesome power of acknowledging a specific envelope of electoral votes when there are two competing slates, or none at all. We don't live in a democracy. The presidential election isn't democratic." This theory ultimately led to Boyer's criminal indictment and the disbarment of the attorney behind the theory, John Eastman. And then there's U.S. Representative Paul Gosar. He played such a large role in January 6th that he asked Trump for a preemptive presidential pardon. Ali Alexander, an organizer of the riot, called Gosar the spirit animal of January 6th. Gosar was the first House member to object to the certification of Arizona's votes. And the list goes on. Jake Hoffman, who sent a letter to Pence urging him to ignore Arizona's voters. U.S. Representative Andy Biggs, who aired the wild-eyed vote-flipping theories with no proof and reportedly asked for a preemptive presidential pardon. Karen Fann, who abandoned her colleague Rusty Bowers and indulged the theories from Rudy Giuliani. Not all of these people have faced consequences. Some have even gained power, fame, or wealth. But despite the efforts to rewrite the history of the day, for example, see the White House's new website, the admitted evidence from the approximately 1,600 federal criminal cases will preserve the real historical record. And when history books are written 30 years from now, they will not be kind to the Arizonans who contributed to January 6, 2021. As one rioter said, quote, "We were wrong that day. We broke the law. Accepting a presidential pardon would be lying about what happened on January 6th. I am guilty, and I own that guilt, unquote. And that was the opinion piece by Stephen Richer entitled, History Will Frown on Arizonans Who Aided in January 6th. Our next opinion piece is written by a guest columnist, Thomas Galvin. It's entitled, Maricopa County Trims Red Tape to Cut Housing Cost. Despite the continued high cost and low supply, the housing affordability crisis has received either short shrift or lip service at the state level. This past year, Maricopa County leaders addressed residents' concerns by overhauling its zoning ordinance, garnering national attention. Maricopa County achieves results on public safety, lowering taxes, fostering economic development, and now housing affordability. In my chairman's address just 1 year ago, I called for an aggressive overhaul of the county's zoning ordinance as part of a broader effort to promote prosperity in the valley. Zoning reforms may not make headlines, but they shape the cost of housing, they set the pace of development, and they influence the character of our communities. For decades, Maricopa County operated with a confusing, outdated, and unnecessarily complex zoning ordinance. It was time to revise, update, and modernize the regulatory framework to reflect our community's needs. The new ordinance was designed by residents and local experts during a lengthy public process, including stakeholder meetings with more than many participants, extensive public hearings, and hundreds of online comments. The result is a better, more streamlined zoning code that removes red tape without sacrificing safety, improves clarity, and expands housing options while respecting the charm and appeal of our neighborhoods. The updated ordinance eliminated 53 pages and 15,000 words. It consolidated 201 land use categories into 137, and it brings clarity by incorporating new, straightforward tables and charts that make the requirements easier to understand for everyone. The new ordinance removes the plan of development requirement for smaller multifamily residential projects, allowing those projects to move directly to the building permit process, thus saving time and money that pays for tenants in the long run. Maricopa County addresses short-term rentals responsibly, aligning with state law while maintaining safeguards to protect the neighborhood's quality of life. Additionally, temporary use permitting updates will result in faster decisions and reductions to outdated restrictions in single-family, rural, and industrial zoning districts, as well as clarifications to rules for emerging technologies like battery energy storage systems and data centers. Housing affordability comes down to a simple measure of supply and demand. Cities in blue states throw money at the problem with rent control and rent stabilization, but they exacerbate the problem. Maricopa County is the largest Republican-run county in the nation. Our success on a variety of issues is due to applying conservative principles in how we govern. Now, the new zoning ordinance isn't about a blanket green light to build at warp speed, but rather an edict for measured, responsible growth without compromising necessary safeguards or recklessly spending taxpayers' money. Every unclear rule, every unnecessary delay, ultimately shows up in the cost of housing. By removing red tape and outdated barriers, we are creating an environment where our housing supply can increase at a quicker rate and Maricopa County's residents can enjoy the great quality of life that they deserve. And that was Thomas Galvin's opinion piece, Maricopa County Trims Red Tape to Cut Housing Cost. And he is the chair of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. We're coming up on 45 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the entertainment section of the paper. We're going to begin by reading today's horoscopes. If you were born between March 21st and April 19th, that's the sign of Aries. And your horoscope reads like this. Being overlooked triggers self-doubt. Are you craving a boss's acknowledgement? Do not expect to get it. For Taurus, birthdays from April 20th to May 20th, the memory of a painful past romance stirs up. You are retreating within. For Geminis, birthdays from May 21st to June 21st, it's not you, it's them. A lover pulls away. Avoid punishing them. Give them space. For Cancer, birthdays from June 22nd through July 22nd, is this relationship a good idea? You have your doubts, but they are mostly unfounded. For Leos, birthdays from July 23rd through August 22nd, are you feeling used by a coworker? Being the nice guy has created more work for you, again. For you fellow Virgos out there, birthdays from August 23rd through September 22nd, are you afraid to lose their love? You are envisioning the end of a relationship before it is barely begun. For Libras, birthdays from September 23rd through October 23rd, a loved one's request or demands interrupt your quiet time. For Scorpio, October 24th through November 21st birthdates, are you putting a Band-Aid on the problem? Talk about the issue. Do not talk around it. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birthdates, you second-guess an impulse buy. Trust that you deserve it. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birthdates, are you criticizing your appearance before someone else can? A real look in the mirror is required. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birthdates, you are staying quiet at your own expense. And finally, Pisces, birthdates from February 19th to March 20th. You deserve friends who appreciate you. If someone is unkind to you, do not brush it off. And that was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren in her column, Dear Abby. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, I'm a 31-year-old woman who is not yet established in life. I have no husband or boyfriend, no kids, no clear direction for a career. I start new, low-level jobs often. My problem is that I look deceptively young for my age. At most, I look 18 or 19. These employers and co-workers and supervisors treat me differently, and some talk down to me. Some refer to me as a girl instead of a woman. Some give me incredulous looks if I reminisce about the 90s. I have even been accused of lying about my age. Some even had the guts to ask for my driver's license. Others talk about how adorable I am if they think I'm out of earshot. I have tried wearing more mature outfits, but they were uncomfortable, and it felt inauthentic. I tried wearing makeup every day, but I just look like a teenager who wears makeup. When I tried mentioning it during icebreakers, it elicited giggles of disbelief. I also tried referring to the year I graduated from college. It doesn't matter that I speak and behave like an adult, because employees have admitted they thought I was just a precocious teen. It doesn't help that my hobbies include cartoons and anime, nor does it help that I can be painfully shy, which I believe many people confuse with inexperience. This has been an issue my entire life, but it has grown more pronounced as I age. The most common and least helpful advice I get is, you'll appreciate it when you're older. Well, I'm concerned with the present. Advice? Signed, Babyface in Rhode Island. Dear Babyface, you look young, you act youthful, and you are following a life path usually associated with someone 10 years younger. This may explain your coworkers' confusion about your age, Some of them may also be jealous or close-minded. It may be time to cut down on job hopping and home in on a career. If you do, your coworkers may have the opportunity to get to know you better. Until then, be cordial, stand up for yourself, and stop letting the remarks get to you. You know who you are, and that is what is most important. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, my wife of 3 years has no respect for me. She calls me vulgar names in public and thinks it's funny. I have a bladder control problem, and she brings that up in public all the time. I'm starting to resent it. I love my wife, but I don't like feeling this way. Please help or give me some advice. Signed, Only Human in Minnesota. And Abby responds, Dear Human, have you told your wife how the vulgar names and ridicule about your incontinence problem make you feel? If you haven't, you should. If you have done that, then reread the first line of your letter to me. Your wife's behavior indicates that not only does she not respect you, but she also has a cruel sense of humor and little love for you. How you choose to deal with that realization is up to you. You have my sympathy. Remember, you can contact Abigail Van Buren in two ways. You can go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can write her a letter and mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90069. And now we are going to turn to the comic section of the paper. In the first comic strip, Pickles, drawn by Brian Crane, there's Earl sitting in his easy chair. His dog is also in the chair, resting its head on his lap. And his wife comes in and she goes, Earl, I found this power cord, but I don't know what it goes to. And he looks at it and says, I think that goes to the old VCR, or maybe the DVD player, or maybe my electric razor, or somebody's laptop, or hair dryer. Who knows what else? In the last frame, he says, Oh, wait, I think it goes to my nose hair trimmer. And she drops the cord going, Ooh. And that was Pickles. And then in the comic strip, Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, in the first frame, Daryl and Wanda, husband and wife, sitting at the table, and he offers her a plate, and he says, Cookie? And she says, Nope, the holidays are over. Time for me to start eating healthy again. And she's got a bowl in front of her, and she says, Leafy greens, fresh tomatoes, crunchy celery, and a wedge of lemon. And he reaches over and grabs a little bite of the salad and says, Impressive. You are an inspiration. And he pops something in his mouth, and he chews it. And in the last frame, he says, And your croutons are little cubes of Christmas fudge. And she says, Hey, I'm an inspiration, not a saint, remember? And that was Baby Blues. And in Peanuts, featuring good old Charlie Brown by Charles Schulz, in the first frame, there's Linus, and he's rolling up snow into a big ball. And here comes Lucy. Hey, what do you think you're doing? And then he says, I'm building a snowman. And he puts the big ball of snow on top of a little ball of snow. And Lucy says, but he's upside down. A snowman is supposed to be fun to look at. And Linus is putting little coal eyes in the small ball of snow on the bottom. And then he's got some twigs. They're going in. Lucy starts to walk away and says, No one is going to care about a snowman who's upside down. And in the last frame, we see the upside down snowman. And Snoopy comes over and stands on his head and says, How quaint. And that was Peanuts. And in Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, in the first frame, Sergeant Snorkel's sitting in a kind of a well, it's not quite a sofa, but maybe it's like a big recliner. And he says to this guy, why do I overeat? And the guy's got a notepad sitting on his lap, and he says, well, it could be caused by anxiety. You might be compensating for something in your childhood. And the guy's got white hair and a mustache and glasses. And Sergeant Snorkel says, well, I did have a difficult relationship with my mother. And the guy says, well, in what way? And the last frame, Sergeant Snorkel says, well, she never gave me enough snacks. And that was Beetle Bailey. And then with Zitz, oh, goodness gracious me. There's Jeremy and his mom. And in the first part of the frame, she says, this is the only thing of yours that actually made it to the laundry room. She's got a big basket of folded clothes on the floor, and she's holding one of his socks. And then she says, and this sink full of your dirty dishes needs to be washed. And then she says, and then go scrape off the mushrooms growing in your shower. And pick up these shoes while you're at it. And in the last frame, he's thinking, her overindulgent parenting skills are really slipping. And that was Zitz, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman. Let's say happy birthday to some celebrities who are celebrating today. Happy birthday to director Joel Zwick. He turns 84 today. And actress Phyllis Logan turns 70. And director Malcolm D. Lee turns 56. The singer and rapper Mary J. Blige, she turns 55 today. And actress Amanda Peet turns 54. And singer Cody Simpson turns 29. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, January 11th, 2026. Have a great day.